Leo Tolstoy wrote a short story about three hermits, Christian monks who lived on a rather remote island. And the bishop was out visiting his various parishes that was spread throughout a broad area, and he was reaching a number of them by boat. One day he went by this island and he asked the guides, "Does anyone live on that island?" And they said, "Oh, Your Grace, just three hermits, but they're difficult, they're slow, they're not literate. You can't teach them anything. Just don't worry about them." But the bishop decided, since they were part of his flock, he should drop in for a visit. And once there, he learned that, indeed, they knew almost nothing about theology or the scriptures. They didn't even know how to pray properly. So he resolved to teach them the Lord's Prayer. They actually struggled to learn it, to memorize it line by line, over and over again. Truly, they were a rather dim trio. But after days with them, he thought they'd finally committed it to memory. So he left them. As the bishop was traveling on to the next island, he saw something approaching from the rear of his ship, and he thought it looked like another boat. But as it got closer, he saw that it was, in fact, the three hermits running to catch up to him on top of the water. When they caught up to the bishop, they cried, "Dear bishop, we've already forgotten the prayer that you taught us." And the bishop, overwhelmed by what he was seeing and hearing, said, "Well, dear brothers, then how do you pray?" They answered, "Well, we just say, 'Dear God, there are three of us, and there are three of you. Have mercy on us.'" The bishop, who was awestruck by their sanctity and their simplicity, said, "Go back to your island, be at peace." You know, the imagery of walking on water finds its way not only into literature, but also into film and into everyday language. We know that from our other connections in business world and so on, that if there's someone that performs at an exceptional level, an incredible level, others who may even be a little bit envious will describe him or her as someone who walks on water. And of course, it comes originally from this passage in Matthew, along with the Gospels of Mark and John. What do we make of it? What's the point of this particular event? And what do we do with Peter? And how many times in sermons do pastors say, "And what do we do with Peter?" This passage immediately follows the gospel reading of last week, where Jesus feeds over 5,000. If you remember, he was trying to get a break from the demands of ministry, the constant press of the crowds, especially after he learned of John the Baptist's death. Instead, the crowds find him, and they follow him. And he spends a long day in the ministry of healing and restoration. And at the end of the day, with no other options, he feeds the multitude as God multiplies a small meal of fish and bread. And it's there that our reading begins today, immediately. So immediately after this amazing miracle of feeding, immediately Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to the other side while he dismissed the crowd. After he had dismissed them, he went up on a mountainside by himself to pray. I mean, Jesus had still not had this moment of peace, this moment of prayer. He'd been continually giving of himself, giving out. And if you know what comes after this passage, he goes right back into a situation where people just come and beg to touch his clothing. I mean, he is constantly on. Maybe sending the disciples ahead of him was a decoy tactic. Maybe they'll follow the boat. Maybe the disciples themselves were a distraction for him. But he still was seeking this time of prayer. Just a small aside here, and that is that for those serving in ministry, either lay or ordained, sometimes we need to send people away so we can recharge. You know, the constant flow of meeting the needs of others is draining, and it can be destructive if it's not balanced with rest and renewal. Jesus knew this, and it's important for each of us as well. So the disciples set off in the boat to get back to the other side of the lake. This should not have been a lengthy or arduous journey. These were seasoned sailors. Yet the Sea of Galilee is notorious for winds and storms that can just whip up unexpectedly. And that's what happened to them here. As a result, they were blown miles off course. They were caught up in a storm that threatened not just the itinerary they had, but their very lives. They had battled the winds all night long. We can imagine that they are exhausted. And this is the first time in Matthew that they were without Jesus. He was praying on the mountain. They were separated from him, fighting this raging storm without his aid. You know, in the biblical world, the sea is often a place of chaos, of unpredictability. As one commentator notes, it's a place that's held at bay by the creative act of God, but it's always seen as something threatening. To the biblical mind, being on the sea is itself a threat, representing all the anxieties and dark powers that threaten the goodness of the created order. If you think about it, in the new heaven and the new earth in Revelation, there is no sea. But here the sea separates them from Jesus, who is the presence of God. So the storm is real for them, but it's also a powerful image as well. But even with the storm, they are not separated from Jesus' mind and heart, because he knows what they're facing, and just before dawn, he goes to them, walking on the water. And you can imagine, they're terrified. Maybe we would be terrified as well, not sure of what they're seeing. And it's not at all what they were expecting. Jesus had not done this before, to our knowledge. There's a sense among the disciples that it must be some sort of spirit, an apparition. But Jesus calls to them in his voice, the voice that they know. And he says, "Take heart, have courage. It is I. Do not be afraid." In their hour of greatest need, in the midst of the storm, Jesus is present with them. I mean, do we know that Jesus is with us when we face the winds and waves of life's difficulties? Do we have the assurance that even when he feels far away, when it seems that circumstances separate us from God's presence, he is with us? Do we know that? The disciples weren't sure. And you know, often we aren't as well. Things can become so dark that we misinterpret his presence, and we see it as something else, even something frightening. This is especially true when the Lord comes to lead us out of trials and into a new place of following him in our lives, because that's change, and change can be scary. Growth can be intimidating, but he always leads us in goodness and in love. He declares himself to the disciples, and he urges them to release fear. I mean, we've had that experience, haven't you, where you're in a really tough situation and a hard place in life, and there seems to be a door opening, a door of provision opening, but it's frightening because it's not what you had anticipated or wanted to walk through, and it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work, and it's a lot of change. I think that's kind of a little bit of what the disciples are feeling. They're frightened because it's a ghost, but also it's not what they expected. But the Lord is with us in our storms. That's the first part of this that I think is such an encouragement, and I want us to see it. And we can apply it to whatever area of life today that relates to. I mean, we can think of numbers of things, but I'm going to let you do that. You know, often Peter gets the main attention in this story, doesn't he? And that's regrettable because Jesus is the focus of this story, not Peter. And it's especially regrettable when we can tend to interpret it the wrong way. Or at least I'd like to suggest that we miss often what's going on here, what I want to call the Sunday school version of how I heard this story and how I've even preached it at times. But it has implications for how we understand what it is to follow Jesus and what it is to live his life in the world. So I've mostly heard it interpreted this way, and see if it doesn't sound familiar to you. Peter sees this great thing going on of Jesus walking on the water, and he wants in on this because, I mean, we know Peter. He's got this great outgoing personality. He's impetuous. He's never one to miss a new experience. So he decides he wants to try this walking on water thing as well. Jesus says, "Okay," and Peter's out of the boat, onto the waves before you know it. He's doing okay, you know, for a moment, and then he kind of figures what his real situation is and how much the wind is and what the waves are, and he takes his eyes off Jesus and he sinks. And in that moment, he cries out to be saved. Jesus reaches for him just in time, And Jesus says to him, "Oh, Peter, you have little faith. Why did you doubt?" And we interpret his doubt, his wavering, as his lack of faith in Jesus to walk on the water. But I'm not sure that's really what we see here. Let's back up. Jesus says to them, "Take courage. It is I. Do not be afraid." Peter replies, "Lord, if it's you, tell me to come to you on the water." See, the disciples are not so sure that it is Jesus. So Peter, as spokesman, presents a test. "If it's you." Now, when he's sinking and in danger of drowning, he calls out, "Lord, save me." He's kind of finally figured out what's going on. And Jesus catches him immediately. "Why did you doubt, Peter? Why did you doubt it was me? I came to you. I declared my word, my identity. Who else could it have been? You know me. Why did you doubt it was me?" Peter puts Jesus to the test, just like he was tested in the wilderness. I mean, think of the language. "If you are the Son of God." I mean, we've heard this before. "If it's you." Jesus comes to them to reach them in their time of terror, and his walking on the water is a show of who he is, the Lord of all creation. It's not a trick. It's not a hoax or a projection of some kind, and I also don't believe it's an invitation either. It was Peter's idea to walk on water, and it was test. It was a test. It wasn't trust. Why does that matter? Well, the way I see it, it matters because somewhere along the way, based on that other interpretation, the Sunday school interpretation, we've picked up the idea that we are to walk on water. Jesus never tells his disciples to do that. That's a sign of his identity. That's a sign of his lordship. Well, you say, aren't we to do the things he did? Even greater things he said we would do. Can't we do all things through Christ who strengthens us? Yes, we can do the things that he calls us to do. Love others. Serve those in need. Forgive. Be long-suffering. To be reconcilers and healers. And sometimes to do great things in his name. But our lives are to give glory to God and invite people to know him. It's about him, not us. In his power, not ours. What did the disciples declare when Jesus got in the boat with them? "Truly, you are the Son of God." They saw. They finally got it. And they worshiped him. And that's where our encounters with the living God lead us, to worship. You see, the danger of walking on water, or the desire to do that, is that we begin to think about life in terms of success, of accomplishment, of attainments, of accumulations, of kind of jumping over the bar that keeps getting raised higher and higher. And even in ministry, the notion of walking on water can lead us to a cult of performance, of chasing goals that always are just out of reach. We're not called to success. We're called to bear fruit, to be faithful. That's how the Christian marks the journey of life. Now, we're to bring our best. We're to bring excellence. And we're to offer all that we have. And you know, God can bring blessing. And there's sometimes great blessing that looks a lot like success. I think about this building that we will soon be worshiping in again. I've had people outside of the church say, "Well, that was really a successful venture that you were a part of." And I know what they mean by that. And I always say, "Yeah, you're right. Thank you." But we know it wasn't about us. It was about the Lord doing this and doing it through us, through gifts that he had given to us and our willingness to be humble in the face of his majesty. This morning, before we went live, we had a lot of technical issues. And Tim Yoder's here, and Tim always does a tremendous job. He had a lot to make up for some stuff that we discovered this morning. And I didn't expect Tim to walk on water. But I knew that he would bring his A game and his excellence. And we actually stopped and prayed, "Lord, help us," right? So it's not this thing about not walking on water is not a call to mediocrity. But it is saying, what do we bring? Because success is about our strength and our exceptional effort and skill. Faith is about our brokenness and our vulnerability, because that is what God can use. Walking on water can sound like a great thing, but it can keep us from the humble task of walking the way of the cross, which is what Jesus clearly calls us to do. Christians go through the water. We don't walk on it. In 1940, Clarence Jordan founded Koinonia Farm in Americus, Georgia. That was a haven for racial unity and cooperation. And then in 1954, the Ku Klux Klan burned it down, every building on the farm except for Jordan's home. And in the midst of that raid, Jordan recognized the voice of a local newspaper reporter. The next day, the reporter showed up for a story about the arson while the rubble was still smoldering. And he found Jordan in a field planting seeds, and he said to him, I heard the awful news of your tragedy last night, and I came out to do a story on the closing of your farm. Jordan just kept planting and hoeing. The reporter continued his prodding with no response from Jordan. Finally, the reporter said, look, you've got two PhDs, you've put 14 years into this farm, and now there's nothing left. Just how successful do you think you've been? With that statement, Jordan stopped. He said to the reporter, you just don't get it, do you? You don't understand us Christians. What we are about is not success, but faithfulness. Jesus is with us in the storm. He declares himself. He tells us not to be afraid. And we don't have to put him to the test. We can trust that he is who he says he is. We can rely on his power and authority over the winds and the things that might overwhelm us in life. We can welcome him into our boat and worship him. Amen.